Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Alice Shaw, and to begin, she addressed one of the most common current questions we hear from medical oncologists about lung cancer, specifically the practical algorithm for tissue testing of tumor mutations. And to begin, she commented on the related oncoepidemiology.
We do see about a quarter of the lung adenocarcinoma patients with KRAS mutations. All the other subsets are smaller than KRAS. So the other subsets are the ones, several of those are the so-called targetable subsets. So that includes EGFR mutations, which we see in about 10 to 15% of our patients, ALK rearrangements, which we see in about 4 to 6% of our patients, ROS1 rearrangements, which we see in maybe 1 to 2% of our patients. And then there's a whole slew of other little subsets of lung adenocarcinomas in the 1 to 2% range, again, defined by a key oncogenic driver and ones for which we may actually have targeted therapies just on the horizon. The main ones, of course, for us to all keep in mind are the targetable ones. So that includes EGFR, for which, of course, we would use erlotinib in this country, and ALK, for which we would use crizotinib. And as you know, in this country, the NCCN guidelines are such that it is recommended that for all patients with non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer at the time of diagnosis, that those patients be tested for both EGFR and ALK. And that's, of course, so that we can then pick the first line of therapy appropriately.
And I guess we should say that's regardless of smoking status.
That is regardless of smoking status. It's a very good point. It's not regardless of histology. There's a clear recommendation to just screen the non-squamous tumors, but that's, like you said, completely regardless of smoking history. And the point behind that, of course, is that even though EGFR and ALK are more commonly found in NUVR or light smokers, it's certainly possible for a patient with a smoking history to have acquired one of these mutations as well. And so we don't want to lose out on the opportunity to identify those patients and have good targeted therapy options for them.
Now, just to clarify, when you say it's recommended for all patients at diagnosis, does that include patients who've had a resection of, you know, potentially curable lesion?
No, this is for patients actually who have unresectable or advanced non-small cell lung cancer. For patients with resectable disease, presumably they've undergone their curative therapy, be it surgical resection or definitive radiation therapy, and we don't yet have a role for these targeted therapies in that setting.
Although, you know, I guess finally I'm hearing that they're going to be adjuvant trials, you know, EGFR mutation and ALK. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe you can tell me what the current status is. But it seems like once those are up and running, I mean, people are going to want to get on those studies if they have mutations.
There are plans for a number of different adjuvant trials looking at adjuvant erlotinib, for example, for EGFR patients, adjuvant crizotinib for ALK resected patients. There actually already are some adjuvant erlotinib studies out there, and there'll be large ones starting. But as you know, these studies take a very long time, both, I would say, to accrue, but also then to wait for the results. So for the time being, all patients, if they're going to be considered for adjuvant TKI therapy or erlotinib or crizotinib, we certainly would do that only in the context of a clinical trial.
So in terms of this testing algorithm, where does ROS1 fit in?
That's a great question. You know, ROS1 is one of the newest targets that we have in non-small cell lung cancer. The preliminary data we have so far is very encouraging that ROS1 is going to represent yet another very good target for crizotinib. This data has been presented a couple times last year where we have a cohort of ROS1 positive patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer being treated on the original phase 1 trial of crizotinib, and the response rate is between 50 to 60% in these patients. And the durability is as impressive as what we saw with crizotinib in ALK-positive patients. The numbers, though, are still small because, as I mentioned, ROS1 rearrangements are rarer than ALK rearrangements, and so we have fewer patients. We're building the numbers for that cohort, but it certainly is looking very reminiscent of what we saw in the early days of ALK. And so I do believe that crizotinib will become a standard therapy for ROS1 patients, but it isn't currently right now. What we do at our institution is, because ROS1 is quite rare, we do the upfront testing for the more common mutations, EGFR, ALK, as well as others. And if those are negative, we then go on to ROS1 FISH testing.
Now, when you decide to go on to ROS1 testing, do you take into consideration smoking status?
Again, we don't. Even though, again, ROS1 is very tightly linked to never or light smoking, it is certainly possible for a patient with a smoking history to have this genetic abnormality. So we screen, again, regardless of the smoking history. It's more if they're already negative for other more common mutations and they have adenocarcinoma histology, we will go on to ROS1 testing.
So without the benefit of a visual here, maybe you could talk a little bit about your concept of sort of what happens with the tumors that are ALK positive, what happens with the tumors, you know, at a genetic level with ROS1 mutations, and what crizotinib does and why it helps with both.
So I think the fundamental sort of problem going on in these tumors is that there's a chromosomal rearrangement. The chromosomes have kind of shuffled around, and that's in ALK-positive patients that's caused a rearrangement of the ALK gene itself so that it's now fused abnormally to another gene. In many cases, it's a gene called EML4, but it really could be almost many other different partner proteins. And what happens now is you have this abnormal expression of a fusion protein where now ALK is turned on basically constantly. It really can't be turned off. And that's what creates this oncogenic driver that's driving the growth of the tumor. A very similar situation happens with ROS1, where again, a chromosomal rearrangement or shuffling occurs. It now fuses ROS1 abnormally to any of a number of different partner proteins so that now ROS1 is turned on abnormally, just the way ALK is turned on abnormally with the chromosomal rearrangement. It's actually very interesting that ALK and ROS1 are very closely related receptor tyrosine kinases. Their active site in their enzymes are very, very similar, and that's, of course, where crizotinib binds. And so biologically, it makes a lot of sense. The enzymes or the protein kinases themselves are very similar, and the drug is able to bind both of them in a very similar way to shut off the kinase activity. And so knowing that, now looking at the clinical data, it makes perfect sense that crizotinib would have activity in both ALK-rearranged as well as ROS-rearranged patients.
I want to hear from you a little bit more in terms of ALK, and maybe you can comment on the paper that you and Jeff Engelman just published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, ALK in Lung Cancer, Past, Present, and Future. But before we get to that, just a couple other questions related to mutations, you know, sort of following up on a few of the things that you just talked about. One is this issue of, you know, you mentioned the adjuvant trials in patients with these kinds of tumors, and you were part of a study that was reported at ASCO last year called the SELECT trial. It was only a one-arm study, but it was in the adjuvant setting looking at erlotinib in EGFR mutant tumors. I'm not sure I've really seen anything quite like it. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what that study showed.
Yes, so this was a single-arm study that was actually several centers. It was led by Alicia Sequist at our institution, where patients with resected EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, after recovering from their surgery, then received 2 years of adjuvant erlotinib therapy at the standard dose. And what was reported at ASCO last year was sort of preliminary data on the patients that had enrolled on the study in terms of the safety, how well, you know, adjuvant erlotinib is tolerated in this population, as well as some data on how these patients were doing. And I would say from a safety standpoint, we saw all the same things you would expect to see now that we know so much about erlotinib. So rash and diarrhea, of course, being the most common side effects. I think what was remarkable is that disease-free survival was extremely high in these patients. So at 2 years, I mean, most patients, 95%, I believe, were disease-free at 2 years, which is the duration of the therapy, which is obviously much higher than we would predict for a similar population of resected patients.
And then it seemed like people started to relapse as soon as the drug was stopped.
There were cases, not everyone, but yes, unfortunately, we did have cases, and I had several cases of my own, that at the 2-year mark, when the adjuvant erlotinib was now discontinued per the protocol, we did have patients relapse. I had several who relapsed, including in the CNS. So there is this idea that those patients who were supposedly completely resected probably did have micrometastatic disease that was kept under control with the adjuvant erlotinib. And when the erlotinib was then discontinued, those spots were now able to actually start to grow. So I think it's a very intriguing trial. We need, obviously, larger study, longer-term follow-up. We need a control arm to see what the true benefit of the adjuvant TKI will be, but I think it's very promising.
What was it like to maintain patients for, 2 years in the adjuvant setting without active disease on erlotinib?
You know, I think it is a bit challenging for patients because they are dealing with side effects and they don't, as you said, they don't have active disease that they know is under control. They very well actually could be cured of their disease. So I think emotionally, it was a bit hard for some patients to be tolerating this therapy. And I did actually have patients as well withdraw from the trial because they just felt that they weren't sure what they were treating and they were having to tolerate the side effects. So that is a bit challenging. I think it'll be if and when we have more definitive data showing a clear benefit to adjuvant erlotinib, I think patients would be obviously much more willing to accept the therapy.
Another concept I wanted to ask you about with relationship to these mutations is the issue of neoadjuvant therapy. And I've heard there might be a trial in locally advanced disease where patients would get sort of a run-in period of, a TKI prior to that. Any comments on that kind of strategy?
It is a very intriguing strategy. I mean, we know that in the metastatic setting, at least, we know these TKIs are associated with a much higher response rate than chemotherapy. And so it's, of course, very appealing to us to think about offering the most effective, the most active therapy up front, especially in patients who are presumably going to then head into surgery and be potentially cured. So as you said, there are a number of trials that are being planned to look at this question. There is a large cooperative group study that will be looking at the role of crizotinib in locally advanced disease. We will also have a single institution study probably looking at, again, specifically stage 3A, 3B patients with ALK-positive lung cancer and using crizotinib both in the adjuvant but also in the induction setting.
That really makes a lot of sense. One other thing before we get into ALK, you mentioned KRAS, and I'm curious where we are right now in terms of agents that might work in patients with these mutations. And I see you were involved in a study looking at an agent called selumetinib. I'm curious what it is and whether there's anything hopeful out there on it.
Yes, I think this is a very important study. This was a study that was led by Dr. Yanni at the Dana-Farber and recently published in Lancet Oncology. And this really is the first study to indicate that there may actually be a viable therapeutic strategy for patients with KRAS mutant lung cancer. So this was a randomized phase 2 trial that involved about 85 patients with advanced KRAS mutant lung cancer. And these patients had already received frontline chemotherapy. They were randomized to receive either selumetinib versus standard docetaxel.
And what exactly is it?
It's a MEK inhibitor. So it targets a key enzyme downstream of KRAS. And there was already preclinical data suggesting that targeting this signaling pathway would be active in KRAS mutant cell lines. And in this study, what they found is that the group of patients who were randomized to receive the combination of docetaxel with the MEK inhibitor, selumetinib, did quite a bit better in terms of response rate and progression-free survival compared to patients who received docetaxel alone. Now, the primary endpoint of the study, though, was overall survival, and there was a trend toward improved overall survival in the patients who received the combination that included the MEK inhibitor, but this was not statistically significant. It was significant, though, in terms of the improvement in response rate and the improvement in progression-free survival. So this suggests that perhaps there's some particular efficacy of combining standard chemotherapy with a targeted therapy, this MEK inhibitor, for KRAS patients specifically. I would say a limitation with this study, of course, was not only, obviously, it was a smaller study. There were about 42 patients in each arm, but also there were quite a lot of adverse events with the combination. So we had significantly more hospitalizations due to adverse events in the patients who got the combination. This is particularly related to neutropenia and febrile neutropenia. I think there was close to 50% of the patients who received the combination were hospitalized, which is extremely high for patients who are receiving standard chemotherapy. So that is one concern about the combination. But in terms of efficacy, I think it's the first sort of promising look that we have into how we might be able to better target patients who have KRAS mutant lung cancer.
So let's talk a little bit about ALK, and maybe we can just reflect back on this paper you just wrote. It's really a great review. And I'm curious what you and Dr. Engelman sort of thought about and what were the main points you were trying to get across.
Well, you know, I think ALK is really just such a fascinating story on so many levels. And in this review, we wanted to kind of capture certainly the recent excitement about ALK in lung cancer, but also reflect on ALK as an oncogene that's been known for a while. So in a way, it was kind of rediscovered in lung cancer. We've known about ALK in anaplastic large cell lymphoma for over 15 years. In fact, that's where it was first discovered as an abnormal ALK fusion oncogene. But yet it's very rare, and actually anaplastic large cell lymphoma patients have potential curative therapies. And so I think people weren't really pursuing ALK as a target that much around the time it was discovered in lymphoma. We also have known about ALK in a very rare type of soft tissue sarcoma called inflammatory myofibroblastic tumor, but again, a very rare type of tumor. And so I think it's interesting that we've known a fair amount of ALK. We've known that it has this potential to be an oncogene. We've known that it's involved in a couple different tumor types, but really not much happened until Dr. Hiromano made really that pivotal discovery and reported it in Nature in 2007 that a subset of lung cancer patients can also have an ALK rearrangement. It's a different ALK rearrangement than what we see in lymphoma or in sarcomas. Nevertheless, the end result is the same, that you create an abnormal ALK fusion protein that can drive the growth of tumor cells. And so really it had this almost renaissance, so to speak, for patients with lung cancer. And part of that excitement was tied to the fact that people were aware, even at the time that ALK was first discovered in lung cancer, we already knew that there was a drug in clinical trials. Everyone knew at the time that this drug, while it had been developed to target MET specifically, it also had anti-ALK activity. And so I think the excitement of Dr. Mano's paper was twofold. One was that it was a new potential target in lung cancer, and at the same time, there was a target therapy that was basically immediately available. And because of that almost fortuitous timing that the target was discovered while the targeted therapy was undergoing development, we were able to test very, very quickly whether or not ALK really was a bona fide target, clinical target or therapeutic target in patients with lung cancer. I think the history really is so sort of fascinating and inspiring in the sense that the Nature report first came out in August of 2007 describing ALK as a potential target in lung cancer. And then the diagnostic test was developed by Dr. Iafredi very quickly thereafter. And he ended up identifying quite a few patients who were so-called ALK positive. And the very first patient with ALK positive lung cancer was able to be treated with crizotinib in December of 2007. So just 4 months after the initial report of the discovery, which is pretty remarkable to imagine going from target discovery to testing a targeted therapy in such a short time frame. And that patient, many people have talked about this patient. It was a patient of Dr. Lynch's actually at the time. And this patient was extremely sick and had one of these miraculous turnarounds. And I think even after that one patient pretty much turning around within a few weeks, I think all of us who were aware of this case knew that ALK was going to be a target and crizotinib was going to be a very effective targeted therapy for that group of patients. Since then, we've actually come a long way because that phase one trial then enrolled quite rapidly around the world at quite a few institutions that were very involved in screening patients for ALK and then treating these patients, these ALK-positive patients with crizotinib. And as you know, these beautiful waterfall plots were generated showing this pretty incredible activity of crizotinib in patients with very advanced disease. And many people talked about these miraculous turnarounds. It really was a very exciting time to be able to witness the early development of this drug for this population of patients. And then in this review, we also talk a little bit about sort of how we've now moved from that phase one trial out to registration trials. And actually what's very interesting and I think is representing a new trend, of course, is that the data from the phase one trial, as well as data from a follow-up phase two trial, was the basis for crizotinib receiving accelerated approval in this country. And that happened in August of 2011. So again, just 4 years after the first discovery of ALK even as a target. So extremely rapid development.
Now, what do we know at this point in terms of clinical research with crizotinib and ALK-positive tumors? What phase two and phase three efforts have been done and are ongoing now?
So the phase two trial was a large registration trial, single arm of crizotinib in patients with ALK-positive lung cancer from around the world. It basically confirmed what we saw in the phase one trial, very high response rates, about 60%, median progression-free survival in the 8 to 9 month range, and a very good safety profile. We recently actually have reported the results of a registration phase three study. This study, of course, is the first randomized study of crizotinib versus chemotherapy in the ALK ALK-positive population of patients. And this trial, of course, supports full approval of crizotinib in this country and was also necessary for approval in other countries, including Europe. So this is a second-line trial. That means patients all received first-line platinum-based chemotherapy. They were all ALK-positive using the standard ALK diagnostic test, which is a FISH assay. And these patients were randomized to receive either second-line crizotinib or a second-line standard chemotherapy, pemetrexed or docetaxel. The target enrollment was actually 318. We ended up over-enrolling to about almost 350 patients. The randomization was 1-to-1, and the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. I should note that this 1-to-1 randomization, including one arm, of course, to standard chemotherapy, it should be noted that those patients randomized to chemotherapy were allowed to cross over to receive crizotinib at the time of progression, because of course we would not want to deprive one of these patients of receiving the targeted therapy. So there was crossover. We crossed the patients over to a different study, the phase 2 study, so that patients would then receive crizotinib in the third line setting. So the trial accrued very, very quickly. Actually, over 100 sites around the world were participating, and we enrolled these 348 patients in about 2 years. And so the results were actually presented at ESMO, and the primary endpoint of progression-free survival was met. And the trial did show that crizotinib is superior to standard chemotherapy in terms of prolonging progression-free survival. Progression-free survival was extended by about 3 months with chemotherapy to almost 8 months with crizotinib. It was exactly 7.7 months, and it was a highly statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival. Not surprisingly, we also saw a very significant improvement in response rates. There was about a tripling of the response rate of 20% with standard chemotherapy to 60% with crizotinib. Not surprising given what we saw with the phase 1 and 2 trials. We did not see any difference in overall survival at the time of the final progression-free survival analysis. I should note that many patients were still ongoing, so there was a high rate of censoring. And as I pointed out earlier, there was crossover, so we weren't really expecting to see any difference in overall survival since the majority of patients were crossing over from chemotherapy to crizotinib. And then the final point I'll make about this phase 3 trial, which I think is one of the most important points, is that this trial did have secondary endpoints of looking at patient-reported outcomes and quality of life. And this trial showed that in terms of symptoms related to the disease and in terms of functioning and quality of life, that crizotinib was associated with a significant improvement from baseline compared to chemotherapy.
What about in the first-line setting?
So it's a great question. There's very limited data on the first-line use of crizotinib. In the phase 1 trial, we had 24 patients who enrolled who were previously untreated with advanced ALK-positive lung cancer, and those patients did very well. Similar high response rate, you know, in the 60% range, and actually their median progression-free survival was 18 months. So it's a very small subset of patients, but we know that at least they're certainly not doing any worse than the average sort of previously treated patient. There is an ongoing phase 3 trial right now of first-line crizotinib versus platinum pemetrexed. That's a study that's called Profile 1014. It's accruing worldwide, and hopefully the target enrollment will be met actually in the next 6 months or so. So we'll have some definitive data on the first-line efficacy of crizotinib in the near future.
So what's the current accepted algorithm, NCCN, et cetera, in terms of management of patients with metastatic disease of ALK mutations or ALK rearrangements?
So NCCN does recommend testing for ALK upfront along with EGFR, and NCCN does recommend the frontline use of crizotinib in patients who are found to be ALK positive. I actually found that to be an interesting recommendation because it's really not based on any more of the data than I just mentioned to you, which is the 24 patients that were treated on the phase 1 trial. There's really no other first-line data out there. But given the precedence with EGFR, obviously, and our very solid understanding of the biology of ALK-positive lung cancer, I think NCCN felt that there was a strong reason to support using first-line crizotinib.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you reflect back. I guess it's been not even 10 years since EGFR mutation was detected.
Right.
I remember talking to Tom Lynch about this right at the beginning. And, you know, as soon as I heard about it, and I think every other oncologist, you know, who treats other cancers, it was like, oh, okay, yeah, of course you're going to use it before chemo. It was kind of, it reminded me a little bit of endocrine therapy in breast cancer, you know, less toxic. I mean, why would you wait? And yet, you know, there was a lot of resistance to that in the beginning until IPASS and these other studies came out. And I think it's great that the NCCN and other groups are now sort of moving beyond that and sort of seeing in a larger sense.
Right. And I have to say the same is true for the FDA, because the label in this country for crizotinib does not specify anything about prior treatments. And so in this country, we can prescribe crizotinib first line or beyond. And I would say most practitioners, again, influenced by the EGFR story, if they have a newly diagnosed patient who's found to be ALK positive, will prescribe crizotinib, which is consistent with the guidelines from the NCCN.
So, of course, one issue is an issue with EGFR and EGFR TKIs as well, is the issue of resistance. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know when patients progress on crizotinib and some of the newer agents. I know there's one that's still in the letters and numbers stage that sounds real good. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yes. So, you know, these targeted therapies like crizotinib do work so well. I mean, these responses can be really so dramatic and they can be very durable. However, resistance seems to be inevitable for all of our patients. On average, patients will develop resistance to the targeted therapy, usually within a year. Sometimes we have patients who can go several years, but I would say on average, we see the beginnings of resistance within about a year of starting on treatments. And so this, of course, is a very active area of research for many investigators around the world because it's a huge limitation to the targeted therapies. We know a fair amount now about crizotinib resistance in ALK-positive patients, and this is from, again, a number of groups who have looked at patients who have become resistant to crizotinib and have re-biopsied those resistant tumors and now studied them at the molecular level. And what we know is that about a third of patients have become resistant to crizotinib because of a change, an additional mutation within ALK. So the ALK fusion that was originally there is still there, but now it's acquired a mutation. We call it a secondary resistance mutation that now interferes with the binding of crizotinib. So crizotinib can no longer shut off ALK anymore. And we see these types of mutations. There are a number of them. There's the standard gatekeeper mutation in ALK, which is L1196M, which is analogous to EGFR T790M. But in addition to the gatekeeper, there are a number of other ALK resistance mutations as well. So it's kind of an interesting difference between ALK and EGFR that we see quite a few different resistance mutations for patients with crizotinib resistance. We can also see changes in the number of copies of the ALK fusion gene. So we have amplification of the ALK fusion gene that can also mediate resistance. But in the remaining two-thirds of patients with crizotinib resistance, we actually don't identify any changes within the ALK gene itself. And what we've seen, at least in the lab and in some early studies of patient samples, is that there's almost certainly activation of alternative or so-called bypass growth tracts that can now basically allow cells to ignore, you know, the inhibition of the ALK signaling pathway because it's activating alternative signaling pathways. And some of these can include EGFR or c-KIT and others. The whole reason we do this work on resistance to crizotinib is that hopefully that will allow us now to come up with better therapies for patients who have progressed on crizotinib. And there are a number of new strategies in the clinic already for patients who have relapsed on crizotinib. I would say the most exciting sort of class of compounds right now for patients who have relapsed on crizotinib are the second generation or so-called next generation ALK inhibitors. These are also oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target ALK, and they do so more potently and usually more selectively than crizotinib. There are several in the clinic already, including LDK378, AP26113, AF802, and a number of others. And these are all in preliminary studies, so phase one studies already showing very promising signs of activity in crizotinib resistance. LDK378 is probably the furthest along of all of the ALK inhibitors. This is, again, a very potent, it's about 5 to 10 times more potent than crizotinib. It's more selective for ALK. It does not inhibit MET the way crizotinib does. And in an ongoing phase one trial of LDK378, we've now moved from dose escalation into dose expansion and even into a phase two trial. The maximum tolerated dose was already established about almost a year ago now. And this trial has enrolled over 200 ALK positive patients to date. And we already have very, very solid efficacy data showing a response rate of over 60%. And this is in crizotinib refractory or resistant patients. And so far, the durations of response are also quite impressive at over 7 months. So this seems like this whole class of compounds seems like it's going to be a very effective salvage regimen for patients once crizotinib stops working.
So maybe you can comment a little bit about the issue of tolerability and side effects of crizotinib, because there are a couple of sort of weird things. And I know there have been a bunch of papers that you've been on, Dr. Kamage, and a bunch of other people. But the couple of things that really struck me was this issue of visual changes and also hypogonadism. Maybe we can start with those two things.
Sure. I mean, overall, crizotinib is very well tolerated. And I think if you polled oncologists who have treated with both crizotinib for their ALK patients or erlotinib for their EGFR mutant patients, I think most oncologists would agree that crizotinib is actually easier than erlotinib. By and large, the most common side effect that we see with crizotinib is the visual disturbance. It's seen probably in close to 80% of patients who are treated with crizotinib. It tends to happen within the first couple doses. And it's a very characteristic disturbance where patients will report that they see any of a number of different things, visual trail, shimmering lights, various scatterings of light, but only in the setting when they're changing from a dark to a light environment. That's really what seems to trigger it. And when patients, for example, during a typical day, when there's no change in light, they will really have no visual disturbance at all. These visual side effects are actually quite mild. They tend to last only, you know, anywhere from 10 seconds to a minute. And like I said, because they tend to only occur at those times where the lighting is changed, most patients report that they're really not bothersome. We have done ophthalmologic exams as part of the clinical trials and really have seen no abnormalities on the eye exam. And when this drug is either held or just permanently discontinued, the eye disturbance is completely resolved. So it's a reversible drug effect. We don't exactly know why, but it is very characteristic with crizotinib.
Sounds a little, from what I've heard, it sounds like a little psychedelic in a way.
It does. You know, in fact, we have talked about it with various ophthalmologists, and it has sounded like apparently it's similar to what patients might see when they're on LSD.
Really?
I don't know what that's like.
I mean, the way I've heard people describe it, you know, that's kind of what I was thinking about. But actually,
right.
I wonder if it's even chemically similar. I mean, not the drug, but how it affects, I don't know, is it the retina?
Right. We don't know. We don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but I have definitely heard it compared to the visual symptoms that patients on LSD experience.
Wow. Interesting.
The next most common side effects with crizotinib are GI related, so nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or constipation. Generally, these are mild. We do encourage patients to take the crizotinib with food. That definitely alleviates the nausea and vomiting quite significantly. There are rare patients who have nausea and they'll require, you know, pre-medication with ondansetron or other anti-nausea medicines, but by and large, the nausea is very minimal when patients take crizotinib with food. The bowels are a little bit, I would say the disturbance for the most part is pretty mild. Diarrhea is generally managed with the typical antidiarrheal drugs and constipation with a typical laxative. So again, not a huge impact on quality of life, just sort of side effects that I warn our patients about. The other actually more significant side effect to be aware of with crizotinib is the risk of transaminitis. And in the phase 3 trial, we did see about 15% of patients with grade 3 or 4 transaminitis, so a significant transaminitis. And we have had a few cases where there was associated liver failure. So we do follow the liver function tests closely. I follow them every 2 weeks for the first 8 weeks because the chance of having a significant transaminitis seems to be highest between about 4 to 6 weeks after starting. And then after the first 8 weeks, I follow every month the liver function tests.
Could I just ask, I assume you interrupt the drug, but do you then restart it?
Yes.
And are you able to?
Yes. So anecdotally, in my experience, we've been able to, you know, the elevated liver function tests will improve once you hold the drug. And we've been able to restart the crizotinib, usually one dose down, in all patients except one, and this is over the last, you know, almost 5 years. So almost all patients have been able to tolerate a reduced dose of crizotinib. The other side effect that we should talk about is the hypogonadism. And this was first reported by Dr. Kamage's group about a year ago now. And what they found is that in 19 patients, male patients treated with crizotinib, that there was a decrease in total testosterone levels. And in some cases, they did measure free testosterone as well. This led to this concern that crizotinib could be causing hypogonadism in our patients. And so we've been actually testing as well to determine how significant this is and also to actually now start screening our patients more for symptoms of hypogonadism. I would say in our experience, we find that total testosterone levels definitely are reduced when patients are treated with crizotinib, and sometimes free testosterone levels, which really are the physiologically sort of relevant levels of testosterone, can be normal to low, but not uniformly low in all patients. And a large part of this seems to be because the main binding protein for testosterone, which is a sex hormone binding globulin, or SHBG, is significantly reduced by crizotinib in all males. And so the main component of the reduced total testosterone seems to be related to a very steep decrease in this SHBG protein. And sometimes that seems to then translate into a decrease in the free or physiologically relevant testosterone.
So what do you see in the gonadotropins?
They're normal. There's no compensatory increase, for example. They're actually in the normal range. So I've been screening our male patients as well by symptoms, and I would have to say that it's somewhat of a complicated story that I think needs a lot more work still. I mean, many of my male patients really do not have symptoms of hypogonadism. Fatigue is reported with crizotinib, and I would say I see it fairly evenly distributed between men and women. I have not seen many males. I would say about 20 to 30% will report specific symptoms of hypogonadism. So, for example, fatigue, sleep disorder, or sexual dysfunction. And for those male patients, I will refer them to endocrinology. And if they have a low or borderline low testosterone, they will sometimes go on to testosterone repletion.
And is anything like this seen in women?
We don't know yet. It's certainly not been reported, and we have not been consistently looking yet. It's harder in women, of course, because the cycles are different. So we don't know. But, you know, I think one point to make is that, again, looking at the phase 3 trial where we looked specifically at quality of life issues, functioning issues, and I would say the quality of life on crizotinib is very high. Both males and females report very good quality of life. And I think if hypogonadism really were a very significant problem in the male population, we might have detected some of that in our patient-reported outcomes.
Although, you know, particularly in the situation of metastatic disease, you know, if there is a treatable cause of fatigue, I guess it's worth knowing about.
Absolutely. So for right now, what I do is I do screen all my males before they start crizotinib as well as while they're on crizotinib. And if they have low levels, so they actually fall below the lower limit, I will refer them to endocrinology if they're interested. If they are symptomatic at all, regardless of levels, well, especially if they're low, then of course we talk about repletion. I've actually had about 20% of my males, even before crizotinib, who I find have low testosterone levels already. So that is something that we see in our cancer population, and that may make the story a little more complicated, that there's already pre-existing hypogonadism in a subset of patients.
Well, that's interesting.